On board the G&M Family Market phone line, we're pleased to welcome back to the show Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Bob, good Friday afternoon.
I don't know what to read into that song intro.
I know. That was not, it's not a reflection on you. Clearly. Well. I think we're talking about me, probably, is what. Or, you know, maybe it is. Maybe that's our farewell to Pablo Sandoval.
Well, that could be. That could be. But this was long overdue. We all know. And it's still, I'm still sitting here trying to contemplate being in a business where you have to swallow a $50 million lump of coal. As part of the deal that the Red Sox are on the hook until further notice somehow for that amount of money. And I'm not the only person that they're paying dead money to as well, but that's the business. But boy, that's a stunning sum.
Well, you know, it strikes me that it's a little bit like a college recruiting when you have to go into somebody's kitchen and figure out if they're going to be a good fit for your campus. But this seems to be a new development in professional sports that in the past, I don't know that general managers worried as much about whether a guy could play in a certain environment.
Well, this isn't the case with him. I mean, this is simply, it doesn't matter what environment he's in. He was not in shape. Whatever magic was in that bat that produced a record 26 hits in the postseason prior to his coming to Boston has disappeared. His fielding was never, it was only adequate at best, and of course, totally deteriorated. But you know what? I bought into the idea in spring training that he would have a comeback year. I thought they were going to be in good hands at third base. I thought that the weight loss and the pride that it seemed to come from would propel him into a good season. That was wrong about that. But in this case, we're not talking about the personality. As a matter of fact, the personality was excellent. You'll hear this to the end that he was popular in the clubhouse. There were no his inability to perform had nothing to do with his phobia about playing in the market. That may be the David Price issue, but if it is, but it certainly wasn't Sandoval's.
Well, it's always good to be in first place at the All-Star break. The Sox have themselves with a 3.5 game lead, despite some highs and lows along the way. Is this team in a good position heading into the second half tonight?
Well, number one, I'm an AILC guy, so it may be 3.5, but to me, it's 2 because it's in the loss. There are 2 up in the loss, and that's all that matters to me. The factor of the W's are irrelevant. It's the losses, and they're 2 up in my book now. That said, I feel good. They have survived no production at third base. The immediate hit to this rotation that they suffered when Price was unavailable to start and they lost Stephen Wright for the year. And then Rodriguez has been in and out. And they still have managed, thanks to Sale and also the stability somewhat of Pomerantz and the closing of Kimbrel to have enough pitching to get where they are. The B boys have produced well, all 4 of them, and I think they'll get better production out of Betts in the second half as well. And they got a big bonus from Moreland, who wasn't supposed to be as prominent as he's been. Pedroia, something of a comeback, although the power that he once had will probably never come back. But all in all, they should be feeling good about where they are, and I do buy into the party line that their best baseball is ahead of them.
All right, we want to look back, though. We're really spending a lot of time this month talking about the 67 Red Sox, that impossible dream team. And we've chatted about them with you before and their importance in Red Sox history, really turning around the franchise. And one of the guys who I think often gets overlooked in a discussion of that team is Dick O'Connell and his contribution.
You are so right. Dick O'Connell was brought on, hired on the 16th of September, 1965, the day that Dave Moorhead pitched his no-hitter. And he actually stole the headlines because he had taken over from the longtime crony and drinking buddy of Yawkey, Mike Higgins. And people didn't know a whole lot about Dick O'Connell. He wasn't a baseball purist guy. He had come from a different background, although he had then entered into baseball. But people didn't know much about him and the outside world. And he engineered a lot of things that made 67 happen. Made some important deals during the course of the season, a big trade near the trading deadline to bring in Gary Bell, later picked up Jerry Adair, picked up Elston Howard, and these were all instrumental in it. And he provided the stability to the organization that lasted. And yes, he is not as well remembered as he should be.
Dick Williams, certainly and deservedly so, gets a lot of credit, mostly for bringing in a new attitude to this team, starting with his opening statement as manager.
Remember that their reputation was this was the country club team. Tom Yawkey was a paternalistic owner. He loved his players too much and had favorites, Ted and Yaz and a few others, and liked to play in the, you know, he played Pepper when they were on the road, and he hung out in the clubhouse a lot, which owners say or, you know, simply don't do. But all in all, produced a comfort level that was not warranted by their W's and L's. And Dick Williams came in and cleaned house. He came in as a drill sergeant and immediately changed the but they weren't using this phrase then, Rich, but what he did was he changed the culture and ahead of his time. Absolutely made the famous proclamation, we'll win more than we lose, which people scoffed at. And now, in retrospect, of course, we now have to be reminded that they were actually pretty good in the second half of '66. They had the second best record in the American League after the All-Star break, although it only got them up to ninth place instead of 10th. But still, I didn't really think about that too much until several years ago when a friend of mine pointed it out. But no one believed that there was any relevance to him saying they were, or any credibility to him saying we're going to win more than we lose. No one expected anything out of that team. And as we all know, it provided us with one of the great pennant races, but for many of us, and I'll put my hand up right here, the greatest fan experience I ever had, be it high school, college, or professional, was rooting for the 67 Red Sox.
Bob Ryan with us here on Downtown. Carl Yastrzemski these days is one of the most beloved players in Red Sox history, but what people forget is that going into that 67 season, he was under so much pressure and viewed by a lot of people, despite the batting title in 63, as a disappointment as, well, anybody would be following Ted Williams out in left field.
It wasn't easy to follow Williams. He followed him directly. He was a rookie in 61. And you're right. He did win that one batting title, but he was a doubles hitter. They thought he was moody. There were some issues. He was an excellent fielder, but he was a singles and doubles hitter. And then we all know the story. It's a stuff of mythology, but it happens to be true that in the summer of 66, 67, he made a policy decision to try to upgrade his level. And he decided he needed to get in better shape. And he hired a Hungarian expatriate named Gene Birdie, B-E-R-D-E, up at the Colonial Country Club in Linfield, Mass., to be a personal trainer. And he put Yaz through a winter of rigor and maybe one of hell. And he came in the best shape of his life. And the second thing is, he decided he was going to pull the ball. And I don't know whether he got help from Ted or not, because Ted was always there as an instructor in spring training. But he began to pull, and that was evident from the start. And he wound up upping his homer total to 44, and became for the rest of his life became a pull hitter who eventually wound up with over 450 homers. That was not in the cards entering the 67 season. He was 28 years old. And he turned 28 on August 22nd, 67, and who knew that he was going to last 16 more years? By the way, turning on fastballs as late as his final at-bat or his final week, when I saw it happen, he was actually still taking extra batting practice the last week of the 83 season, because he was determined that he was going to retire without people saying he couldn't turn on a fastball.
The golden boy of that team was, of course, the local boy, Tony Conigliaro, who went down on that fateful night in August on the pitch from Jack Hamilton. How good was Tony Conigliaro?
On his way to 500, maybe 600 home runs. He was only 22 years of age. He already was the first guy in the American League to hit 100 home runs before 20. I think the only other guy was Millot. And he had won the home run title in 65. Was at the time of he got hit on August 18th, 20 homers, 67 ribbies, was maybe as good a clutch hitter as Yaz that year, even though Yaz got more publicity for it, and was on his way to a golden career. And of course, Fenway, he was made to hit in Fenway. He hit fly balls, not line drives, and of course, Fenway was made for that. And he was a good fielder, and of course, he was the ultimate local boy, makes good, living at home, and it was a pop celebrity guy. He had a hit record, not a local hit, a two-sided hit, playing the field in a little red scooter. I have one. I bought it. And, you know, you had to have it, just like you had to have Yaz bread
right
that year, that summer. I was there that night, Rich. I was in the box seat down the third baseline. I got a foul ball in the first inning, the only one I ever got in the stands.
Wow.
Jimmy Hall popped one up, and it rolled right under my seat. I didn't even have to move or fight anybody. And anyway, I was there that night, and it was a bizarre, surreal night. Believe me, a strange, strange game overall, and of course highlighted or lowlighted by Tony C getting hit.
And they would not have had the success they had without the work of the guy known as Gentleman Jim, Jim Lomborg, with a 22-win season, really a season for the ages, won the Cy Young Award, won the pitching Triple Crown that year. And while he'd been a pretty solid pitcher, that was an unexpected season.
No, it was. He was a 9-17 at 1 year. He was he went to Venezuelan League, some winter league, and he started pitching inside a little bit. Then he got the gospel preached to him by the infamous or the famous or the wonderful, whoever, Sal the Barber Magley, who was the pitching coach.
Right.
And he, of course, was known for, he got his nickname because he gave close shaves to batters. And he, once it was said of him, he would throw his grandmother. Oh, that was early Win. I don't want to get him confused. But he was, nonetheless, he was famous for being a ruthless competitor and a guy who would pitch inside. And he preached that gospel to Lomborg. Lomborg, in his first two full seasons, hit 19 guys. That year he hit 21, and as he points out, 20 of them unintentionally. Of course, the one famous one was in New York Yankee Stadium in June when he hit Thad Tillotson, and as they were embarked on a beanball war that night that had actually started the night before. And but he'll tell you all about the fact that he certainly did throw that ball at Tillotson, and all hell broke loose, and that was a fun night in Yankee Stadium.
Bob, what was your favorite moment of that 67 season?
Well, of course, October 1, being out in the stands on October 1 and being there for the whole experience of it. I went to 27 games that year, and there were some wonderful ones, of course. But the one you'll always remember is October 1st. And it's starting with a bunt in the sixth inning. He leads off the sixth, Lomborg does. Now, in the National League, without a DH, he wouldn't even, in today's game, he'd never bat in that sixth inning, down 2-0 in the sixth. But he was down 2-0 in the sixth, and he leads off with a bunt. And then it goes right, from then on it goes, Jerry Adair hits one up the middle. I can still see Rod Carew, the rookie second baseman, diving to his right, but not able to knock it down. Then Dalton Jones hits one in through the hole, through the Tony Gwynn 4.5 hole. And now the bases are loaded and Yaz is up. And if there was ever a thing we could all be sure of in our lifetime, it was that Yaz was getting hit at that moment. And he ripped the shot up the middle for two runs, and the inning continued on with crazy stuff, and they wound up getting five runs. Then if we get to the eighth inning, and the Twins get a run, and they got a run in, and when Bob Allison doubled into the corner to drive in a run, but then he made the fatal mistake. He tried to take second. Yaz threw him out. And I always remember watching Tony Oliva look out at second base, staring at Allison, fuming at Allison. And 1999, when we had the All-Star game and we had the 100 greatest players here, they had a wonderful affair, and many affairs at Fenway. And I was able to speak to Oliva, and I said, I got to ask you something. I said, on October 1, 67, when Allison was thrown out at second base, and I can still see you standing, staring at him, what were you thinking? And he looks at me after a long pause and says, with gritted teeth, that was a long time ago. So that was your answer. That was your answer, folks.
Do you still have the scorecard from that game?
I certainly do. It's framed on my wall in my office. And the scorebook, I was using a big, big scorebook in those days. And I'll have to be honest, the one you see, if you were to come to my office at home, is a recopied, neat one from the original. But it's the exact scoring that was done that game. But I recopied it, and it's framed with these ticket stubs from the box seat that my wife and I, my girlfriend then, my current wife of 48 years, and I think probably the everlasting one. I used the word current, but I think that doesn't mean she's on probation. So I think we're going to make it to the finish line.
Oh, I think so. Bob, before we let you go, we're saluting the Beatles this month, a part of the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper. And I know you're a big fan. When did you first become a Beatles fan? Did it start with the Sullivan Show or later than that?
No. My God, no. That's Johnny Come Lately. If you waited till the Sullivan Show, you're not fit to take part in the discussion. No, I became aware of them in November of the previous year in '63. Jack Parr had a show, not his late night show. He had another show that I believe was on like 10 to 11 on a Friday night, and he showed an excerpt clip of this hot new band in England that was taking England by storm, the Beatles. That's where I became aware of them. Then, of course, I Want to Hold Your Hand and I Saw Her Standing There hit in late November or in early December of 63. And that was their first hit here, although their first hit was Love Me Do way back when. And but that came here later. But they hit America with I Want to Hold Your Hand, and of course the flip side, which I like even more, which is I Saw Her Standing There. And so by the time they came in February of 67, of 64, we were all waiting their arrival. It wasn't like I discovered them then. That was Welcome to the Shores of America.
Do you have a favorite Beatle album?
I have a favorite Beatle album, which is Rubber Soul. And I think, to me, there's two kinds of Beatles fans. The kind for whom they peaked with Rubber Soul, or the people think that they really got great with Sgt. Pepper, and then they like the White Album and all that. I'm a first half Beatles guy more than I'm a second half Beatles guy. I love Rubber Soul. I don't think there's a bad cut on the album. I think it's all wonderful. I also like, I like all the early stuff. But Rubber Soul to me was fantastic, and that's my favorite. Nothing against Sgt. Pepper, I like it, but there's a couple of clunkers, but there's no clunkers on Rubber Soul.
Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and the Bob Ryan Podcast with Howard Bryant this week.
Thank you. Yes, Howard was outstanding. He's talk about a guy with a background that talk about sports in the last 20 years. Here's a guy who worked in Oakland, San Jose, Boston, New York, and North Jersey, Bergen County Record, covered the Yankees and the Red Sox. He's covered directly the Oakland A's, the New York Yankees, the Boston Red Sox, and the Washington Redskins. He's got experience. He knows people. And I think we just sat down and just talked sports. And I really, I highly recommend it. If you just want some unadulterated, pure, fun, no BS sports talk, then I think you'll like this chat with Howard Bryant.
It's always great, the Bob Ryan Podcast, and always great to talk with you, Bob. Thanks, as always.
Nice for having me. Bye-bye.